great. It's my first entry back into the podcasting scene after my semi-epic trip out west to the California coast. Seen
a bunch of folks. Yeah, and I saw you. So you met a lot of Criterion cast and just people we know on social media.
Yeah, yeah.
You made definitely. The rounds.
It was a really incredible week for me. It was kind of a reunion with old friends from decades ago, my old bandmates and a few other folks from that scene. And then a lot of folks that I've met only on social media, recorded podcasts with. I got to experience a little bit of Los Angeles, Hollywood, as well as my old Bay Area stomping grounds up in the Northern California area. So a pretty whirlwind tour. And I got a few stories, little anecdotes I can maybe toss in here and there. But it's, it was a great experience, something I've been kind of dreaming and thinking about for a while. And just to have a chance to meet like my Criterion cast buddies and a few others in the flesh, people who've guested with me on podcasts here and there, and to just kind of get to know them as real people and see where they live and where they work and what they do and kind of round out the picture was a really wonderful opportunity. I was hosted by some really great folks and really grateful for the hospitality I was shown and just for the chance to get out there and do something pretty unique.
Yeah, it looked fun.
Yeah, you painted a really nice picture of a whirlwind trip there.
Thanks.
You did, yeah. And Keith, that's tough to follow, but what have you been up to?
Well, I'm in the throes of a home remodel project that has been going on for, I think, 17 years, or at least that's what it feels like. So I've just been moving furniture from one room to the next and then, clicking refresh on the Criterion page. So that's my entire life for the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah. Any shelf moving or just non-shelving?
Well, my shelving is attached to the wall, and I did not want to move all my discs again. So right now, my entire collection is hermetically sealed behind plastic while we get ready to paint the living room. So, yeah, a lot of streaming for me right now.
A lot of streaming, yeah. That's right. I saw that picture.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of everything's in a hazmat suit there, just exactly. Behind the barrier, yes.
Well, just real quick, I want to just give a couple Patreon shout-outs. One is a correction. One is, I think I'd called him Mark Miller last time, and I couldn't find him in our social media, but it's actually Matt Miller, so I apologize, Matt, for writing down your name wrong and not finding you. I think I was confused because I have an actual friend named Mark. And Matt is a member of our community. And then we also have another member of the community, Greg Anderson, has supported us. So thank you both for jumping into the fray. And yeah, hope you enjoy this exclusive Patreon stuff. So without further ado, shall we get right to the turd sandwich?
I hear the birds are cawing over here for you, Keith. Yes. They're saying, eat me.
Let me get to a little stage setting. So, Keith Enright, you were on our show, I don't know, probably a couple months ago, 3 months ago?
I think it was late May, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, a couple, not long, that's not long at all. Mm-mm. And you started talking about something, and it was really interesting, and I kind of like saw where you were going and kind of shut up and let you go through it. So you had a bold prediction. You thought that Orson Welles was going to be Spine 1000. Welles would be the Spine 1000 would actually be the set, and then each individual title would be 1001, 1002, etc. So, and you said that if you were wrong, you wanted to come eat crow. And then, of course, the turd sandwich was thrown in because you had threatened to eat some of that this week as well. So, what's on the menu today, Keith?
Well, I think we're just going to have to eat a little crow because the I hate to phrase it this way, but the turd sandwich was tongue firmly in cheek.
yes.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously that was a bold prediction that I had a lot of fun putting together, trying to figure out exactly what would be in a Orson Welles versus the Smog Monster set. but, I even said at the time that was, even as I was saying it into the microphone that day, that thinking to myself, wow, this is an amazing amount of wish fulfillment that's probably not going to come true, but a lot of people jumped on it, and I started to think, this still would be really pretty cool. And people would kind of tear it apart and say, well, I can see this coming, but not that coming. And I'm like, hey, everybody, just we're shooting for the moon here. Why not? Let's just go for it. But I think it became apparent, was it 2.5 to 3 weeks ago now, as the rumbling started, that it wasn't going to be that. And I actually, when people started talking about Grand Budapest Hotel as 1,000, I went, damn, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So, you know, I was pulling back from my fantasy world there in varying degrees throughout that. But then it started to really become apparent that it was going to be Godzilla, and I had my moment of mourning for my eating crow, but then got pretty excited about what this was going to be. And then as far as the turd sandwich goes, I mean, that was almost me doing performance art, because before that I even talked about a cheese sandwich too,
because
hyperbole was getting so ridiculous about all this, and you know, at one point I was going to sell my entire collection, bidding starting at a cheese sandwich. And then I saw some artwork that somebody was purporting was going to be it that I didn't like. And I said, you know, I'm going to sell my whole collection for a turd sandwich. And, you know, I think everybody pretty much got the joke. I had one guy who said, geez, why does one selection ruin your whole collection? I'm like, well, you didn't. There's got to be a better sarcasm emoji out there for stuff like this. But, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit, but that whole 10 days was by turns a lot of fun, and also some of the most exasperatingly ridiculous noise I'd ever heard on social media.
Yeah, can we just be glad that it's over, actually?
Yes, I think there's a big sigh of relief. But I'll tell you what, Keith, you know, you can take some consolation in that your fantasy prediction of the comprehensive Wells box was probably overall more positively received than the actual announcement from Criterion. You know, there's less division, less spite and strife and dissension stirred up by your speculations than what we actually got. But
I'll take that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're well received, but
you might want to call Jonathan Terrell and ask him for a job, since you obviously had the better idea.
Yeah, apparently. But with the same box art, that's what I would have went with the Day Glow Orson Welles box. That would have been great.
With the monsters on the cover,
stomping and breathing fire. Exactly.
Yeah, I could see that that cane being painted that way. Well, I David, a little shout out. Not to you specifically, but on the Criterion Cast little 10th anniversary show, you guys actually called it. So you guys are the only ones, I think, that until all the hints started to come out, that really speculated that it could be Godzilla.
It's funny. I kind of considered myself the bridge between Keith and Ryan, because, you know, I was pretty much, my little take in that episode was, you know, kind of, you know, getting on board with Keith, but then I started drifting in my thoughts and thought, well, how about King Kong? I mean, you know, King Kong, this big old beast. And I thought, well, how about the Godzilla set? And then I think Ryan took the ball and just ran with it. And I'm not saying he took my idea. I think he probably already had his decision made, but he very unequivocally called it, and I think it really makes sense. I mean, the fact is, when they did the Olympic set at 900 with, you know, whatever that was, 27 discs and 100 years of films, they really set a bar. I mean, just even a single disc release at 1,000 would have seemed very anticlimactic after that. And when you look at the properties that they had in hand, I think Godzilla made a lot of sense for a lot of different reasons. You know, they could make an oversized box or book or, you know, whatever that is, you know, a pasteboard, whatever. And with the artwork and with the, you know, the massive series of films all under one spine number, it's one of those rear view mirror things where, yes, it all makes perfect sense now, but yeah, it was kind of an anguished road to get there. I felt like a lot of air got let out of the balloon between the 15th and the 25th when it was finally announced. So a slightly anticlimactic celebration, but still, it's going to be a pretty incredible item to have on the shelf when it finally arrives.
Yeah, well, glass half full. At least we only have 2 weeks until we hear about the Spine 1001, right?
That's there right, yeah.
There you go. And so then we're back to Kane and King Kong again.
Or Mirror. So are we happy, Keith? Are you happy about this Godzilla? I know that the community has been mixed, ranging from...
I actually I actually am. I'm pretty excited. You know, to David's point, though, after 10 days of all this churn and excitement and deflation and all of that.
I Comic-Con mean, thing, and how that was.
Yeah, exactly.
The Target leak, yeah.
I mean, when the thing came out, I mean, if it didn't wasn't actually shooting fire out of its mouth, I think there was going to be a little bit of disappointment because, you know, it popped up on my screen and my first reaction was, oh, there it is, you know. It wasn't a whole lot of excitement. Well, of course, excitement, but not extreme excitement. And, you know, I'm the same age as David, basically. So, you know, a lot of Criterion fans, I would assume, are some of the younger people that did not grow up watching these on Saturday afternoon broadcast TV. So, you know, without that nostalgia thing, I can see where this is. Not as exciting to some people, but of the people of a certain age, I mean, it really, film fans of a certain age that grew up, you know, watching genre stuff like this, I mean, I think it really scratches an itch. And, you know, I'm looking through it, and I've probably seen most of these. A couple of them I look at, you know, it's like, maybe I don't think I've seen this one. And, you know, as a cinema fan now, of course, I'm much more excited to see the original Japanese versions. I mean, I think that's right. That's the calling card for the whole set. I mean, to actually, you know, see these how they were intended is pretty exciting.
So you're not a fan of bad dubbing? We're going to get some of that.
Yeah, that's one retro nostalgia thing that is not necessary. I mean, yeah, we'll have some of that. It's like watching Rashomon with its English dubs. It kind of makes your teeth wobble a little bit. But you got to watch a little bit of it just to sort of get a sense of how 1950s American audiences first experienced it. But you don't really have to go the whole nine yards with it.
Right.
But I do feel like these are you know, genuinely important films from the fact that this was my first exposure to Japanese cinema, or even really foreign films in general. And and really the way I realized it was, obviously you see all the Asian characters on screen, but all the I'll just speak very parochially here, but you know, from a Midwestern boy's point of view, all those funny looking names at the credits, you know, I didn't know anybody with the names like that when I was a kid, but it certainly planted seeds. It opened my eyes. It got me curious. And then, of course, samurai films come along a little bit later as a teenager, and they're off and running. But really, you know, the fact that Japan, this nation that the United States was at, you know, blood chilling, incredible hostility just a generation earlier, was now kind of directly feeding the imaginations of a whole generation of American youth. You know, and that's continued through anime, manga, Pokemon, Nintendo, all of that. But really, Godzilla was literally a big foot in the door to expand our cultural horizons. And
through the door.
Yeah. Through the roof, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Plastic suit foot.
Right. But, you know, just as a, from a, you know, more kind of serious cinema perspective, you know, I was certainly not ready for Ozu as a 9-year-old kid, right? But, but this. It kind of to Daisuke's very eloquent post, which I think definitely deserves reference and maybe even a little analysis here. I recognize this is not the Criterion of Bergma, Kurosawa, Fellini coming at you for Spine 1000. And so for people who are really deeply into the art house side of Criterion, you know, this feels a little maybe anticlimactic, as well as the delayed release announcement. But, you know, let's look at King Kong was Criterion release number 2. So they've been doing kind of big, cheesy monster, you know, genre flicks right from the absolute beginning. So this is as Criterion as it gets.
And as you mentioned, Daisuke had a very nice post in the Now group, and he said that this is, you know, if you're talking about Ozu and Kurosawa, they are of course important, but they don't really signify or Japanese cinema, but this does. This is the stuff that really did cross the pond back in the day. I'm not that they didn't, but this has, you know, it's more of the lifeblood and more representative of what the Japanese enjoy. And it certainly has audiences here. I think it'll be a popular set. Don't you agree?
Yeah.
I mean, sales.
Did I read somewhere? I mean, this is completely, you never know what to do with this information, but, you know, I saw somewhere that somebody was saying they're doing a print of 40,000 to start. I have no idea if that's extremely large or what, or even true, but I would expect that they, expect this to sell more than their average bear.
Yeah, I think Bergman's probably the benchmark. So we'll see. So yeah, if that 40,000 number is correct, you know, we'll kind of get an idea. If this sells out in a week, then that's pretty impressive, and mm-hmm. they'll probably print 40,000 more. Now, of course, I haven't seen, aside from the original, which is already on Criterion, I haven't seen the other films. I haven't seen them, you know, from start to finish. But and I think maybe that's, I'm just slightly younger than you both. So I did not, and you know, this was not my Saturday afternoons. Although I have, actually, no, I take that back, because one of them, this is probably the first crossover of MST3K and and Criterion. So I believe there's either one or two films in this box set that have also been MST3K episodes. So I have seen those.
Yeah, I could imagine some of those late 60s, early 70s getting the MST treatment there. I don't know which ones they would be, but yeah, that's the other interesting thing, is there is kind of a long-running saga or arc going on with these Godzilla films. Like any other series, they're kind of a mirror of their times. You know, you go mm-hmm. from Godzilla as the world-threatening villain to the benevolent protector and buddy boy monster, you know, who befriends children and you know, keeps the Earth safe from hostile aliens. But then you get the environmental concerns, the technological Mecha Godzilla thing towards the end of that run. And it's just really going to be a fascinating experience to watch this character unfold. You know, it's in some ways very similar to the Zatoichi release, in that it kind of mm-hmm. takes you on a journey with a character that requires a very significant suspension of disbelief. But once you get into it, it's like this really incredible world that's been created. And I will enjoy watching these films uninterrupted, you know, high quality definitions. I mean, I think about watching them on a 13-inch, you know, color TV with, you know, constant commercial interruptions, bad dubbing.
Well, you had color, huh?
Well, you know, at my grandparents' house, anyways.
Yes.
So, do you think these are binge watch worthy?
Oh, I think they are. If you're into it, I mean, obviously, if it's going to be a struggle, if you just really feel like you've got better ways to spend your time, then don't bother. I mean, you're not maybe mm-hmm. going to discover something here that you didn't discover before, if you've given these films any kind of a try, or if you're just not drawn to this type of thing. They go down light and easy, you know, and you don't need to be locked in watching every moment. You can wait for the big set pieces to unfold. They'll be very consumable.
If you bring positiveness to these, you'll find that. If you bring negativity, you'll find that as well.
I think that's kind of the case with a lot of not just film content, but just life in general.
Oh, sure. Of course.
And I think let's dig in just a bit into this set. So it's going to be large. You know, it'll go with these misshaped items on the shelf. So with the shelf where I have, and probably you both have, the Olympic set and the Bergman set, Zatoichi, this will...
Trilogia,
yeah, yeah. I have it.
But this one has height, though. This is like 14 inches high, and I mean, most of our shelves are not built for that. If you're looking to put it in spine order number, that's a bit of a you know, another kind of agitation factor there, you know, so... I'm not sure. I'll have to sort of see how it sits. There's no way I can display it vertically in spine order number. I mean, the Bergman box is on a completely different floor of my house, you know, so, but it's not spine number, so it's okay. Right. I can deal with it.
Well, hopefully they'll both be by the TV for a while, but I guess vertically might be your only option. I think there's a little clearance between the Bergman box, so I have a shot with my new shelves, but yeah, I'm not going to. Not going to worry. The good thing is there's not a whole lot of these, so you know, I think they kind of work on a shelf of their own.
What if all the spines from 1,000 on are in this new format size?
Yeah, that's going to be it. See, we'll all have to buy new shelves for our completionism.
But we'll get 15 spines per book, so that's good.
There you go. So yeah, we'll just the whole month will come out in one book.
There
so
you
go. So the supplements, I'd say okay. Well, the reception has been mixed, and Jesse had a funny point in one of the groups. He said that he saw a lot of people that this is not their thing, but people are really happy that other people are happy, which is that is a common take. I've seen that.
And it's kind of like we're having a party, but half of the guests are kind of like, whatever. I don't want to be a wet blanket here. So they'll kind of grudgingly concede, hey, glad you're having some fun with it, you know.
And that's kind of, I'll say that's similar to my take. And it's not because this is not something I'm interested in. It's just something, you know, unlike you guys, it's something new to me. Now I'm going to enjoy it. Kind of like Zatoichi when that came out, that was new to me and I enjoyed that. But some people I think really treasure this and the true fan base. And there's a large fan base out there. So
yeah, there will be a non-Criterion faction of fans. I mean, I kind of subscribe to the more general interest Criterion Facebook groups and such. And there's a lot of, you know, this is my first time ever pre-ordering straight from Criterion type of comments, you know. So there's definitely a pouncing going on here from people who are, you know, strictly genre fanatics, but see the Ultimate Godzilla set and they're salivating for it and they don't care about Spine 1000. They're just happy to get their hands on this thing.
Yeah, they just want these movies in print. It's light on supplements, and I'm actually that's the most surprising, and I wouldn't say disappointing because I it's hard to be disappointed with such a release for me at least, but not much new except for the ones. In fact, I'd say that what was on the Godzilla disc is pretty much half of the entire supplements. We have a new interview with Alex Cox, which I'm sure will be very enjoyable. He is a you know, he knows a lot about cinema, has a lot of passion, and I love watching him listening to him talk about cinema. And some new archival interviews with some people that were involved with the cast and crew. I think that's really it, isn't it? Oh, there's one documentary, I think, that might be new.
I don't think there was a lot of supplemental stuff. I mean, I don't think that, you know, they have, you know, a lot of extra features from Japan, you know, making of types of stories, you know, TV interviews with cast and directors and whatnot, you know, other archival materials, probably pretty limited. I mean, these were kind of cranked out and even maybe somewhat disposable types of films.
Sure.
Yeah.
You could hear from the guy that wore the suit and he can talk about how sweaty he was for 3 weeks.
Yeah, you can hear from the guy in the suit in the suit.
or even just see the suit. That would be fun. I'm sure there'll be something like that.
Well, I'll cop to being a bit disappointed because, you know, once I got past the Bergman set, then I started to do my wish fulfillment on what could be in a Godzilla set. And, you know, David Kalitz's commentaries on the first movie and the American counterpart are very, very enjoyable, and I enjoy listening to him talk. He's put out a pretty definitive book that I'm in the middle of reading over the last few months on Godzilla and the entire series, where he, you know, he admits to the silliness of it, but still treats it with as much seriousness as you can. And I would have really liked to have seen his imprimatur all over this thing and you know, even maybe another half a dozen commentaries from him or something. So I found that to be a bit disappointing, only because I had decided in my own head that would have been great. But
We don't know. Maybe it's timing too. Maybe they tried to get this out for Spine 1000, which I think they don't normally do. They usually wait until they have the release they want, and they might just. But there's not that more exclamation point, so I think this is probably all we're going to get.
Well, I think we have to talk about probably the most interesting supplemental feature, in that we're getting Universal's American print or American cut of King Kong versus Godzilla as the major presentation, and we're getting the Japanese version as the supplement. And it makes me wonder that somehow that's all, you know, messed up in rights, where when you know, when Universal bought it in 62 or something, they had, you know, they had American rights in perpetuity or something. It seems odd that would be the one that was presented as the canonical feature.
And that might have been the delay. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, we don't know. But something clearly, we know that they intended to release I would guess they intended to announce everything from October at the same time, including Godzilla, and yeah, who knows why 10 days, and of course they went out with the announcement of the other four films, or four releases for October. What do you guys think of the covers?
I think it's one of the major selling points. I mean, it's really...
And the book.
Yeah, the book, the covers, you know, it's not real clear what's going to be in the book itself. Is it just going to be the illustrations, kind of like the Zatoichi with probably an essay or something? But
That's what it appears to be. Yeah.
Every single one of these covers is completely poster worthy. I mean, if you really wanted to go all out, you could paper your entire room or home theater or whatever in this type of stuff, or even select one or two images that are, you know, most beloved, you know, most apropos for your environment. I think Criterion, if they have the ability to market these as standalone or larger than even the book size posters, they should go for it, because there's some really incredible work done here. I mean, there's definitely distinctive styles, but the eye-popping colors are also kind of thematically unified as well. So it's a very, I mean, even more so than the Zatoichi series, which has lots of different artistic styles. These kind of flow together, but they're not carbon copies. And obviously there's a lot of individual talent on display here. So to me, that really elevates this to the next level and makes it worthy of a kind of a celebratory landmark Spine 1000 type of a thing.
Yeah, I was thinking poster. Imagine having posters of all of these, but actually, what makes more sense is that they do their postcards. So if the 2019 postcard book, it'd be very cool if it had all these, or they might just do another one just with these covers. That would be neat.
That's a good point.
So are we still on the Criterion completion bandwagon? We're in a new millennium here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is a question, and I've kind of jokingly said, well, if Spine number 1001 sucks, then I'm not going to get it.
So that's your jumping off point, maybe.
We shall see. Let the drama continue for a couple more weeks at least, and we'll go from
there. All right, you're on notice, Peter Becker and John Terrell. Keith, you're still on board? No turd sandwiches?
Of course. There are no turd sandwiches here. I was looking to get a turd sandwich for all of this. I don't think it tastes that good. Yeah, I know it. No, I've said this many times. My shelving is good to about Spine 1500, and as we're doing our remodel here, I still have I kind of keep glancing around the condo here looking for where I could put the next shelving. Don't say that to anybody, but so no, of course I'm not. I'm in until they pull me out of here in a big box.
Well, you have a lot of years to plan for Spine 1500 and where to go from there. I think we all do. So well, let's now think about the next milestone, which will be, 1331. Is that Leet? I don't know. Yeah.
1337.
I don't know this stuff. There will be some more fun puns that, 1111.
Hey, sure.
That'll be one. Yeah. And then, of course, 1001 could be something. We'll see. Although, since 999 wasn't really too special, I think maybe that, you know, they're at 1,000, so you know, we're
just spending way too much time on spines, you know. Because, you know, the fact that 999 was not the devil's, just the fact that, you know, it turned out to be a John Sayles movie, which I'm ecstatic about. But my first reaction was, oh.
I'm sure the Criterion, you know, marketing, packaging people are just like, no, we are done with this Spine number nonsense, you know. At least give them a breather, you know, for a year or two. Yeah,
I think it's revealed that the spines are more important to the collecting community than to Criterion, which is, you know, I guess if anything, they created this monster, you know, pun fully intended. I think we've covered Godzilla and we're on board. Sure, maybe not exactly what we hope, but there's plenty. In fact, we're about to talk about some really cool things coming. But if you don't mind, since we didn't get, due to the releases, we didn't get to talk last week, do you want to just kind of indulge us and just give some quick reactions to the October, David?
Yeah.
The other titles?
Sure. Well, okay. So we've got the reissues. I mean, the von Sternberg, I think, was very welcome. There was no real clear read on when or if those were even going to come back. But I do feel a little bad for those who paid the extra secondary, black market premium for the OOP editions. But, it's definitely great. Kind of like with the Fassbinder set, from last month, whenever that came out. It's just good to see the box set's getting the upgrade. Obviously, that's not always been the case, like with the Teshigahara set. And we wondered if Criterion was kind of, a little leery of re-releasing big boxes that had already kind of had their initial print run and sold out. And no, they're still at it. So I'll chalk up the Teshigahara. We only got Woman in the Dunes because they just for some reason couldn't get those other two for permanent, disc distribution. But and then Hoxton is definitely a great, great restoration upgrade, great cover. And then the two, When We Were Kings, Meituan, pretty solid. I think again, putting Godzilla as the frosting on that cake would have been a much more exuberant, ecstatic July 15th celebration. For a four release month, other than the Godzilla, when was Godzilla even coming out? I didn't even
It's
catch the
29th, I believe.
Okay,
Same
so
month, yeah.
right
Same day as
before.
Meituan.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, I'm pretty happy with it. I don't know that I've had a lot of brilliant new insights to offer. I still quibble with that visual clue, the When We Were Kings cartoon, Wacky
Right,
Cry.
yeah, the beat poet
You
one.
guys kind of picked that one apart, but I'm just right on board with you in your own analysis, like. What were William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg doing on that bench? Yeah. So anyway,
I on
or
Twitter I
Coppola.
sent on Twitter I sent Jason Paul in a very, very pleasant and respectful tweet saying, "Now that this is out, could you explain that to us?" But I got nothing but crickets on that.
One thing I want to say is that on the last show we were a little confused about the title of the John or the pronunciation of the John Sayles movie, and it had been too long since I'd seen it, but somebody corrected us, and apparently the town of Matawan is they pronounce it Matawan, but in the movie it's pronounced Matewan, and somebody said it's in a hillbilly voice, so Matewan. I get it. All right.
Yeah, let's just say yes and move on.
Meitwan. So, Meitwan, Keith, do you have any reactions to the October slate? Just with Spine 1000 notwithstanding?
The same as David, I thought that, releasing it by itself without 1000 kind of, took a bit away from it. The Haxan looks fantastic. Great cover upgrade on that. The Three Silent Classics by Sternberg is, it's I saw them years ago, and I will revisit them on Blu-ray. That's fine. It did kind of seem like that it might have been a release that they had kind of ready to go, and when Godzilla wasn't ready to go, they threw it in there to make it look a little beefier on the 15th. That's pure speculation based on nothing. And
It tracks.
yeah, the it was, it's a nice slate, but it did kind of smack of let's just kind of throw these out there and get us to 1000 because that's where we need to be. But looking forward to watching all of them. I think I had, yeah, I've seen every one of these movies, but of course, looking forward to owning them and revisiting.
Yeah, it's a great release. So I guess with Godzilla included, and we always compare it to November with the Bergman box. So with that being a 10 on that scale, what would you give on a scale of 1 to 10 this month, David?
Well, I think I'll go with a 9. I think this is a pretty memorable lineup, important films, and I do feel like the Godzilla is right up there with, some of the more significant overall packages that Criterion's ever put out. I'll probably still stay on record that I'm, well, the Bergman box is is number one, the Olympics is number two, maybe the 50 years of Janus Films is number three, and Godzilla is number four, if I want to rank the
maybe AK-100 in
oh
there.
Well, I would put Godzilla ahead of that, just because the AK-100 is with no supplements. It's a beautiful product, but it's DVD only. They could have done better with that. I mean, it's very suitable commemorative to Kurosawa. I don't want to take away from that, but as far as its attractiveness at this point in time, I'd put Godzilla ahead of it, because I feel like you're just getting the more complete package. I mean, you know, having all those Kurosawa films in one box is nice, but without the supplements and only on, you know, standard definition, that knocks it down a notch.
Well, hang tight. We might have other big, massive filmmaker boxes to talk about.
Well, I think that's going to be maybe, if not an annual tradition, I think Criterion definitely recognizes that's kind of a bar that they've set for themselves now. Yeah.
So how it's a high bar.
How do they even try to navigate not putting out one year? They're going to get some pretty noisy complaints about that, but it's a good problem to have.
I don't think they complain about the they care about the complaints, but I think if these sell, then I think that's what it's going to drive. I mean, not just of course they are a business, and they're driven by. They have to sell product in order to just stay and keep the lights on. But I think it's more if they can deliver what's in their value proposition is the historically important, culturally important art house films. If they can deliver that in a format where people will consume and purchase them like Bergman, then yeah, more box set go Criterion. Thank you. So, Keith, you didn't give a ranking. What's compared to...
Last year it's always going to be a 10. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, just as a Criterion fanatic, that I don't think even by definition I could ever go under an 8. I'll give it a 9 as well. I mean, it's a fantastic release month. That really the only reason that we even feel maybe it's not a 10 is because just that we heard so much before it actually happened.
I think you're right. I think that some of the buzz of the month just did sort of weigh down, and then when Target had that page, I'm sure Target had a good talking to somebody at Criteria. I noticed they took down the page a couple of days later, and I haven't checked if it's available for sale though. But that'd be a pretty strict penalty. So yes, because it was leaked a couple of days prior, and I think we all pretty much knew it was. Not as suspenseful the last week or so. Well, so let's move on briefly. But on the topic of big boxes, I just want to bring up two. So in order, so there's now a lot of buzz about the Kiarostami set, and there's Janus released a very beautiful poster on their account. I would like to buy that one. I know I have a lot of posters, and they also released the retrospective trailer. And they look great. Taste of Cherry looks really good, restored. I hear that the Wendell Carry Us is going to be included, and they mentioned their shorts. It's going to be quite a quite an extensive offering. Now, so likelihood, do you think we'll get a Kiarostami box, or do you think it'll get the Wim Wenders treatment?
I think this is Wim Wenders all the way.
Yeah, I don't see a massive... $200 plus Kiarostami box. I think they'll parcel it out.
Okay. And are we okay with that? And they already have Coker coming.
I'm okay with it, because I'll probably buy the individual releases as they come out, and I wouldn't necessarily want to have to repurchase them all in a big box, in 2021 or whatever, if they get around to doing that. But if they do, I will.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'm okay with it as well, although my concern is, I think it's a very viable way of doing it, obviously, but, using Charlie Chaplin and Wim Wenders as examples, the frustration is they don't seem to get around to some of them.
It takes a while.
Any sort of reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, it took a while I think we had a good 2-3 year Chaplin drought, really.
Yeah.
Well, as somebody who just recently got, as Keith would put it, complete again for one more week, because I got a gift card from work and I finally bought the film trilogy by Bergman and Shame, which were the two that I didn't really feel an urgent desire to pick up.
Because, I'm still wrestling with that.
Yeah, I'm not going to open them, but I was like, okay, well, it's technically free money, so why not, just to say I'm complete. But yeah, I would appreciate not having to buy a lot of Kiarostami's and then be faced with buying the set. So the other big box that was rumored, there was that podcast that Lee Klein was on, and you know what, we kind of covered the majority of that last week, so I'm not going to dig into that too much this week. But he did say that 2020 will most likely be the year of Fellini, and I think that's probably a pretty strong candidate for the next big box. And I think that with the Studio Canal rights maybe coming back into play, I think that there might be more avenue for a box. So would you say that's pretty likely?
I'd say
more. Well, I'm pretty convinced that that's what it's going to be. But if you have 10 minutes, I'd like to tell you my Orson Welles
theory. you might want to wait for the pee break for that.
Just put a link to the previous episode there, Aaron, in the show notes, okay?
We'll go. Yeah, I think we might do that anyway.
I think a Fellini celebratory, you know, centennial or centenary box makes a lot of sense. I think it'd be a great opportunity to get things like Variety Lights and The White Sheik and some of those other DVD only, because there's a lot of DVD only Fellini out there. Mm-hmm. That even if you threw in the Blu-ray transfers of, you know, the more recent releases, and then get some of his later career stuff and really have that, you know, career retrospective, I think that would be a wonderful package, and I think it would be very popular, and it would be just a very fitting tribute. I mean, you know, again, Kurosawa, Bergman, Fellini, that's kind of the foundation of Janus Films, you know, and
right,
and,
that's history. Yeah,
exactly. So, and it would be a great treat to have that same kind of curated guided tour through Fellini's you know, oeuvre that they did for the Bergman set. So I would like to see him in the similar dimensions and nice companion pieces on the shelf, and then maybe one of these years they can do a Kurosawa box along those same lines. That would be a great kind of a trio.
An Ozu box. Yeah, I think there's plenty of opportunity. But hey, Criterion, please, the same size. It would be really great to have like five of these stacked next to each other. The curated order, I have to chew on that a little bit, because Fellini's career, you know, his late versus early, I don't know. I think almost chronologically makes more sense. Of course, Keith, you've probably done Fellini Film Festival, right?
Actually, I'm only about 70% on Fellini right now, and it hasn't been in chronological order. I've just been filling in slots, so I would love to see it all in a box and take that route. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess if it's chronological, it would be easier just mechanically to get them watching that way. I think that would be the best way to watch Fellini, honestly.
Oh, I think so. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned The White Sheik, so I'll just also mention that they've released the lineup for Venice Classics, and The White Sheik is on there. Mm-hmm. And the one thing Lee Klein mentioned was that Italy is doing a lot of restoration work on Fellini's stuff. So I think that's where this will be sourced from, of course. And The White Sheik may just be, you know, I wouldn't say the start, because I'm sure work is already underway, but there's probably going to be a lot more. And there's also Crash, Way of a Gaucho by Jacques Tourneur. I never know how to say that. So it looks like some interesting stuff at Venice this year.
Yeah, it does. Of course, we hope and expect that we get that Crash 4K. You know, and as they certainly seem to be diving into the Laserdisc coffers these days, we can hope, maybe expect for that to come.
Yeah, so supposedly that's a 4K NC-17 new director's cut. So that's, and this is one of the big omissions, I think maybe the major one that I haven't seen from Cronenberg. So I don't know if, you know, if it's worth waiting for that, but yeah, that would make sense.
I have the Laserdisc. I watched it in the 90s, back probably before I was well prepared for a movie like that. I need to watch it again, and I'm sure I will appreciate it more. But it's challenging, that's for sure.
Speaking of a filmmaker that you should go chronological order, I mean, come on, pair that with The Brood.
Yeah.
I think that would be good. Have you seen it, David? I'm sure you have.
Yeah, I've got it on DVD. It's been quite a few years, but yeah, pretty impressive film, and definitely the one big missing Cronenberg, other than some of maybe his later stuff that Criterion has had the rights to and would be well advised to get it back when they can.
Yeah, as opposed to the much later stuff, which we probably you're probably not going to see History of Violence or anything like that. Most violent no was it a Most Violent Year? Was that I don't know. I'm mixing up my violence
Yeah, Eastern Promises, I
Eastern
think, right?
Promises. Yeah, and one thing I liked about the Venice lineup, and I'll put a link in the notes, is it geographically it's very diverse. There's a Buñuel in there as well,
Yeah,
and
one of
there's
his Mexican films, which is really, I'm just really waiting for a definitive whatever of those years of his career that's criminally underexposed and poor editions. Maybe it is an elements thing, but man, oh man, I would
Maybe.
love to see more of those films get whatever restoration they could do, would be incredibly welcome.
And there's Portuguese, Iranian, so yeah, the whole act of curation, the global act of curation that Criterion is doing, it seems like maybe just the whole film restoration movement is kind of picking up on that. Maybe because there's a market for it through labels like Criterion. You think that holds water, Keith?
I do. In fact, I was watching, I rewatched Scorsese's King of Comedy last night on Amazon Prime, and even noticed that that was a hadn't undergone a restoration in 2013. And I really think that as much as so much of this is going to streaming, the actual care and feeding of our films is impressively important these days, and I'm really glad to see that we're really trying to present these things as well as they can be.
Yeah, and there is a Scorsese on the list, New York, New York. So that I think that's maybe obscure enough for Criterion. If it's it's not we're not going to get Goodfellas or Taxi Driver. And I think really that's kind of it for the news, except for, well, of course, the big newsletter. We have a new title basically confirmed, and it was an easy clue, so you don't have to tweet at Jason Pullen this time, Keith. So this was a obviously old bottle of Joy, the cleaning material.
Dish soap, basically.
Dish soap, yeah. I haven't used a lot of Joy. That's not my go-to brand. But we have Old Joy. So that's a Kelly Reichardt. That's with Will Oldham. Who else is in that?
I forget the other guy's name, but
Yeah.
definitely one of my favorite Reichardts, so I'm pretty excited.
It's very typical Reichardt. I mean, when I think of a Reichardt movie, this kind of fits the all. It checks all the
Yeah, it's the
boxes.
epitome.
Yeah, it's slow, good character piece. And then Will Oldham, of course, is a singer songwriter, but and I'd say he's had mixed results as an actor, but fits really well here. Fits into her aesthetic. Have you seen it, David?
I have not. I've saw Meek's Cut Off and what's she did she do Certain
Certain
Women? Yeah,
Women.
right. So
Yeah.
yeah, that's my exposure to her. But yeah, she's definitely been kind of a presence on the Criterion Channel. I think her films have mostly been like limited releases and they go away again, so it's nice to see a little more permanency, if you will. And yeah, I've heard good things about it, just haven't gotten to it. So seems like it'll be a great addition.
Yeah, and that's probably. Oh, sorry, go
Earlier this year, I went. I became Reichardt complete, and
ahead.
I would say Old Joy, along with Certain Women, are probably my top two. So it's a good addition to the collection.
And the good thing is she's pretty readily available now, thanks to Oscilloscope, who I think has most, if not all, of the rest of her library already on disc. So yeah, you can, and of course, streaming, it's easy to find. So yeah, Reichardt is definitely a voice I'd be glad to have more of. And she's still out there, she's still making movies. So, well, that's pretty much it for the show stuff. So if you want, we can just run through our short takes. It's been a while since we've done this. Well, I guess. I guess it hasn't. But David, have you seen any interesting Criterions lately?
Well, you know, I really haven't done a ton of movie watching after my California trip. This is like birthday week in our family, actually, the next few weeks. And I've got a lot of work stuff going on. So the Criterions that I have watched have basically been like research for upcoming podcasts of my own. So I'll be talking about The Heiress later this or next week, I guess, with Scott and Trevor for Criterion Cast. Kind of got into Clute, but that's coming up in my Criterion Reflections timeline, so I'll save my longer take for that episode. But I did, you know, last weekend was the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, the real actual moon landing that really happened, just to make sure that's all settled. But and Criterion had a nice double feature for All Mankind, of course, which I've owned on disc and watched many times over the years, but it's nice just to be able to click it on the streaming box. But they did a double feature, shortened feature, I think it was whether Tuesday night or whatever it was. But this little short 20-minute animated thing called Solar Walk, which I just really, really enjoyed quite a bit. I think it's a Czech or Romanian film. Let's see, the director's name, I should know all this better. Rika Busi, Bucsi. I don't know if that's a male or female, but it's just a really beautiful slice of animation. 2018, last year was released. Probably, you know, made the festival circuit. I'm sure it won some awards and all of that. But I really love it. It's a very different take on space as more of a fantasy mythic type of presentation with lots and lots of ideas, wonderful colors. It's kind of a mix of like the old French Metal Hurlant or Heavy Metal magazine, kind of had some elements of that with some, you know, real state-of-the-art 3D animation and just, you know, lots of whimsical ideas about how the universe is created and how reality is bent by these, you know, kind of playful sentient beings. To me, it's short enough to be worthy of multiple rewatches. I've watched it, you know, three times now and just always find something amusing about it. So I just really want to recommend that. The moon landing itself, For All Mankind, is definitely one of my favorite documentaries of all time. And we actually had a family moon theme party to celebrate the occasion, which was kind of a great time to tell stories about our recent travels. And so anyway, Solar Walk is my short take, so I'll leave it at that.
It's on Amazon Prime too, so yeah. you can watch it if you're a subscriber. Somebody who was it put in For All Mankind on the anniversary and their disc didn't work, which
there's a bronze thing. That was Dave Eves actually who showed that, and that was that's a little bit of a concern, not to sidetrack too much, but that was not a disc that was on the original list that Criterion offered guaranteed replacements for. Yeah, apparently. I think the list has grown a little bit since that very first edition, and my hunch is that Criterion will stand behind it, but it does raise the very troubling prospect of what if there are other bronzings going on out there on our shelves, even as we speak, that haven't quite been picked up yet. So, yeah, there's a little bit of a, you know, anxiety here of are we going to have more of this from that kind of early run popping up and creating problems for us.
I checked mine and it was fine, so I'm crossing my fingers. Keith, what's your short take?
Well, I'm going to check mine as soon as I can get the hazmat material off my shelving. So my piece of flair, and I want to preface
short take.
This by...
It's just a short take, right?
Oh, yeah, short take, okay. Sorry. Yep. My short piece of flair take. I was noticing on Letterboxd, I'm coming up on 4,500 films that I have rated or acknowledged that I've seen. And every day I'm surprised when I find things that you would, with 4,500 films, you would think that I had seen over the years, but never have. And the latest of that for me is Scorsese's Age of Innocence. Of course, I've had the disc since it came out, but you know, I don't treat my purchases as something that has to be watched this week just because I bought it. It's, you know, it goes into the library and I get to it when it makes sense. And finally it was time to watch Age of Innocence, and you know, 26 years later, you know, I consider myself a very pretty strong Scorsese fan. I've kind of gone in and out over the years. But for whatever reason, missed this one, and I have to say that finally watching it all these years later, it was a fine and moving experience. I did go off in my letterbox review, probably a little stronger than I intended to, but we all know that I do that on occasion. I think that the big blemish on this movie is Winona Ryder. Others would disagree and have, right to my face.
We did, yes.
Yes. But just a beautiful piece of filmmaking. I think that Scorsese really went all out on this. And, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis is as good as you would expect. Michelle Pfeiffer was good. But to me, probably in the smaller parts, of course, I think good old Norman Lloyd was fantastic in this movie. You know, he's still kicking. What is he, 106 now or something
wow.
like that?
Wow.
Jeez. You know, the guy who, you know, started out with Hitchcock and whoever else. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, just a beautiful piece of filmmaking. I really, really enjoyed the disc. Great special features. Kind of timely at this point because all of film Twitter seemed to be either against or supporting Thelma Schoonmaker. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Nah.
Well, there's somebody that went on and on about how somebody needs to tell Scorsese that a movie only needs 1 second act and not five. And they took that as a diss on Thelma, and so it became a big thing. And even Janice ended up subtweeting about it in her favor the other day. So again, I love when I finally get around to these movies. One of the things that I really try to stay away from is watching brand new movies when they're brand new. I like to let them gestate and sit there maybe for years and watch it on my own terms and let the movie be, you know, presented to me in its own terms, away from all of the hype and all of that. And I think that for me, Age of Innocence really benefited from that. Because at the age
Certainly.
Of 1993, you know, at the age of 28, I don't think I would have appreciated this as much as I did now. And, you know, as I always say, Criterion is a library. And when it's time to watch it, it's time to watch it. And this worked out well for me.
Well, as somebody who watched it when he was 28, or maybe a little older, a little younger than that, a few years younger, and watched it again recently, I can attest that it's like watching two different movies. So, mm-hmm. And it really is a treat too, but not to my younger self. My younger self was like, why am I watching a Winona Ryder, Michelle Pfeiffer period piece
yep.
in New York? Yep. On that note, so this is one I had not seen, is Europa Europa, Agnieszka Holland. Mm-hmm. And it just came out recently. And I've been trying to crank through some of my 2019 releases, and so I've been watching a lot lately. And this one did stand out, and I had not seen it before. I know that it had some acclaim when it came out. And according to my wife, it had played on Bravo all the time for for two decades, or before, when they were still showing movies, I guess. I found it to be, I wouldn't call it a masterpiece. There are a lot of very well-done coming-of-age war/Holocaust films. It's interesting that subgenre has so many great films. Actually, a number of them which are on Criterion. I would say this is actually, it's a very accomplished work. It's very mature. It's very watchable. Even though it's a good 2 hour running time, it's pretty swift in pacing. So I did enjoy it. I'll keep it short just to keep the show short. And plus, we're going to do our best of the year. So I'll have to think about it. But this potentially could come up on not the best of the year, but the best so far. It could be a conversation for Discoveries. So we'll have to think about that. But I do recommend it, especially if you like period war films. It's very well done. Have you guys seen that yet?
I have not. I actually met with Steven Johnson, you know, kind of member of our community, very kind of spontaneous meetup. He lives right there in Glendale, and I had an open evening free, so we got together and we went to the Americana Mall, and I picked up a copy of Europa Europa, and he got the Heiress. So that's kind of
Okay,
my little
well,
California Criterion souvenir.
the
But
Heiress is the better one,
well,
though. That's
yeah, well,
so
I
good.
already got a copy of that, and have watched it, and definitely looking forward to that conversation in a few days. But I kind of honestly find the coming of age Holocaust war survivor genre a little played out at this point. It feels a little bit almost exploitative to tell those stories yet again. You automatically win the audience's sympathies, but I think this film came out back when that genre maybe was a lot fresher, and there was still material to be explored that didn't feel like you're just kind of beating the same old message over and over again. So I'm looking forward to definitely checking it out.
Yeah, I think it was 1990, so yeah, it's
Right, right.
they're not cranking those out anymore, but I think there's a good 20-year span in which you saw quite a few, and maybe they just happen to be good, so that we remember the good ones and we forget the bad ones.
Well, it's a compelling story, no doubt, but it just becomes kind of formulaic after a while. You've seen so many variations on that theme.
Yep, and maybe we'll have come and see someday, maybe.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's
Well, I was
it.
just going to say,
Oh,
I have not seen it yet, but one interesting piece of trivia is this movie is the reason that Von Trier's movie of the same year is called Zentropa,
right.
because it was supposed to be Europa, but I don't think they wanted anybody trying to figure out if they were going to go see Europa or Europa Europa in the theater that night.
Yeah, how many Europas would you prefer? Yeah, it is interesting. But of course, now on disc, it's known as Europa.
Well, and then
In
U2
fact,
jumped on the bandwagon with Zooropa right after
there you go. Right.
that. Well, at least it wasn't Zooropa Zooropa. I guess if, I don't know, if Tears for Fears made an album, that's what they would have had to call it. All right, well, let's have our pieces of flair. So we're done with Criterion. Do you guys have anything non-Criterion to talk about? David?
Yeah, well, as I was talking about my trip to Southern California, I had an unscheduled evening. It was a Tuesday night, I believe, and I went to go see a double feature at the New Beverly Cinema. This was a retrospective thing that Quentin Tarantino had put together some special programming leading up to the release of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and the night that I happened to have available really were kind of a couple of fairly shitty, mediocre movies, honestly, but it was a really great experience to be there. The theme here, I guess, was, or the connection to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was the casting of kind of a couple of Hollywood pretty boys, kind of pop stars. Frankie Avalon was in a film called Horror House, or also known as The Haunted House of Horror, which was the title card. That way, I guess that was the headlining feature, and then opening for that was Fabian in A Bullet for Pretty Boy. A Bullet for Pretty Boy, very much a cheap Bonnie and Clyde knockoff, a few years after Warren Beatty and Fate Dunaway kind of set the world on fire with that film. Obviously, 30s gangsters, machine gun shootouts were the thing. And so I guess that was the idea, kind of tying into, the Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt casting of the leading man and his stunt guy. So, but just the experience of being there was really cool. There was a retrospective of the Wild Bunch playing elsewhere in LA that night. I got to thank Robert Taylor for hooking me up with some of the options. A Pretty Woman was showing, but I thought, well, I got to go to Tarantino's theater, do the New Beverly thing. And so
Yeah.
just the experience of being there and the whole double feature, the little vintage trailers, they opened with a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and QT was not there himself. I was told that there's a possibility he might be around, but yeah, and I would say he probably had better things to do that night than watch those movies again, because they really are
Probably
like one and a half,
big
two
week for
star
him.
type of thing. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure he had other things, but it was a great little kind of a bucket list pilgrimage item for me to say I was there. Certainly could have wished for a better, more memorable couple of films, but I enjoyed myself quite a bit, and it was just cool
Well,
being in that spot.
good.
there is a connection to Fabian in the new movie, so I
Okay.
get it.
Okay.
Keith, what about you?
I think you might see a little bit of a theme here, but I'm amongst all the directors that I'm trying to close out and become complete on, although Scorsese is not dead yet, so can't call it complete. I've been filling in some blanks with Scorsese, and Another one that I can't believe that I hadn't seen over all these years was Mean Streets. Watched that earlier this week. Also did a rewatch of Bringing Out the Dead. To me, always considered that to be, I think I was wrong on this, but I considered that to be lesser Scorsese. And on rewatch, found that to be pretty amazing, powerful movie. Certainly kind of a mixture of Taxi Driver and About Last Night in some weird way. Or not About Last Night. What am I thinking of?
Yeah, it's a little darker.
Yeah. And then, of course, last night I rewatched King of Comedy for the first time in years. And boy, that movie still continues to make me uncomfortable in a very good way. But Mean Streets was definitely something that inexcusably I had not seen after, you know, what is it, 45 years now that movie came out. And, you know, it always has a reputation of being kind of the first of his gangster forays or mobster forays. And it certainly is that. But I have to say that after having watched Who's That Knocking at My Door only a few months ago, that it really seems to be more of a part of that film. And actually, after I decided that, I went and read about it and actually was surprised to find out that the characters in Mean Streets originally were supposed to be, it was supposed to be a sequel from Who's That Knocking at My Door. So it was interesting to see that I picked up on that, and I don't think it would have made it a better movie because it's a very good movie anyway. But you know, a lot of things that we look at is just generic tropes of the genre. You know, really kind of came out in that movie. And the other thing I would say is the movie Mean Streets certainly made a star out of Robert De Niro, or at least I think it got him the part in Godfather 2. But to me, the real acting, the real less showy, solid acting is done by Harvey Keitel in Mean Streets. And to me, he was really the one to watch and had much more of a character arc than just De Niro playing crazy. And I'm not taking away from that at all, but just in comparison, to me, that was Keitel's movie all the way.
I would love to see that come out on Criterion. In fact, a lot of the movies you just mentioned, I think, have potential. After Hours, I think that's...
That's what I meant, After Hours.
Oh, okay, that makes a lot more sense than About Last Night. Well, we definitely have two themes on this show. We have Scorsese and California and Tarantino now. I'll take the latter. So I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood last night, but I'm not going to say much about it because I think I'll say that I did enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. For a nearly 3-hour Tarantino movie, it goes very fast. Speeds right along. It's wildly entertaining, a lot of fun, a lot of uncomfortable laughter. I'm going to say just avoid the internet if possible. And the less you know about this movie, the more it'll pay off. I think it's okay to know there's a tie-in with the Manson family. I think you might benefit from reading the Wikipedia about the Manson killers if you don't know about them. And I think a lot of us have read Helter Skelter or something else. But yeah, I don't want to spoil anything, so I just would say enjoy it. Go in as blind as possible. Leo and Brad Pitt really are, you know, I don't say this often, but they really do a fantastic job, and they're fun to watch, and you can tell they're enjoying themselves. And speaking of impersonations, there's a Bruce Lee scene that's a lot of fun. And the one thing I'll say, and I think you experienced this, David, at the New Beverly, is you really see that Tarantino, I'm sure he has his flaws, but he loves classic cinema. He loves bad cinema of the 60s even. And that's what you experienced. And TV as well. And he ties that all together. And so you see a lot of that love. There's some really interesting ways in which he works the classic film into his into the film this film.
That was really one of the most wonderful aspects. I mean, obviously meeting the people and getting to know them personally was the topper. But also, you know, folks like Robert and Scott and Ted, mm-hmm. Stephen, they all work in the industry. They all do their little bit to keep this huge, creative thing going, show business, whatever you want to call it. And just driving around again for 2 days, I've already got this down, all figured out, but just being that much closer to the heart of it all, and recognizing, Ted Wilkinson, he said it takes just as much energy and effort to make a bad movie as it does to make a great one, and that quote really sticks with me, because there it's just the work, it's the production. Jordan, of course, Jordan Esso, telling me about some of the telling me about the things that he's got going on in his career. It's just, there's just a level of respect and understanding for the people who really are putting themselves out there and aren't necessarily doing it for the paycheck, because you can put a lot of work into something that pays absolute zero when the project gets derailed or things don't come in. But just sort of understanding, just from a little bit more of a up-close perspective, what goes into making these movies that we love to talk about, think about, and banter with. It was just a really wonderful opportunity for me to see that, experience it personally, and my hat's off to all the creative folks who are doing their piece, little piece in the puzzle, So it was a great time.
Cool. All right. Well, let's wrap it up. So where can people find you online? Keith, are you still there? I think we might have lost Keith. So yeah. David, where can we find
you? I feel like I've cut out here. You guys hear me?
I hear you.
Yep, now you're back.
You there? Okay. Well, people can find me at CriterionCast.com, the kind of closely allied network, buddies with 25th Frame and all that. Hi, Keith, we hear you. I'm doing my little Here's Where to Find Me. So, yeah, I'm going to be resuming the Criterion Reflections podcast pretty soon. I got a main episode of The Heiress coming up, as already said. We've got Clute. We've got the Tales of Beatrix Potter and other cool stuff coming up. So that's where you can find me, and I look forward to connecting once I get back in the podcasting groove here. So yeah, Aaron, thank you for getting me back on here. This is a good warm up as I get my own program restarted after my little break.
Well, I think we're losing Keith, but I think he would say you probably can't be found except for unletterboxed. You can find us 25th Frame Masterfeed, listen to all these great shows, support our Patreon and Criterion Now. I'll be taking a little vacation, but I don't think that'll slow down the show too much. I think we'll still be able to come back with it. So, all right, gentlemen, well, thank you, or gentleman, since I think we lost Keith.
Thank you.
There's Keith.
He's back. Okay.
Hey, there I am.
Take care, guys.
Can you hear me at all?